Hi, good morning. I'm Gary Sweeten. I'm the founder and president of Sweeten Life Systems, putting on this seminar, workshop, gathering. We never knew what to call it. And it really is a culmination of a year-long research study. We did in-depth research study with a big, long name on it that is different than most research because we sent questionnaires to 12 families, couples, and then followed up with that questionnaire after they filled it out for an in-depth hour and a half to two-hour conversation with those families. We had two researchers go into the homes. Those interactions and the questions were audio-taped and video, or sometimes videotaped. And we learned a lot from that because you go over it and watch it again and look at it and think about what the family's saying. Because we want the authentic voice of mom and dad. Mom and dad are the key people in caring for, delivering the services or anything for the children. So I've been a counselor, a therapist for a long time. And when you think that in a week you might see a family as a counselor for 50 minutes, that would be about right if they're coming in for help. But there's 168 hours in the week. That family is somewhere else, 167 hours. So who is going to deliver the most care? You, who sees them 50 minutes a week, or they, they're spending 167 hours a week with each other? And a doctor may see you once every few months for 10 minutes. Most doctors are allowed at 6 minutes to see a patient. 6 minutes. Wow. That's why when you go in, the nurse sees you, weighs you, and all that, but you don't see the doctor that often. But we tend to think that the experts are people like me. You know, I've got a doctorate and a master's in counseling. I'm, quote, the expert. That's what we call the myth of the expert. The experts are moms and dads and the family. Now, the other thing is that we know that when there's any change in any member of a family, any person gets sick or has a good experience, it affects everybody else in the family. And that's what this little workshop is going to be about, is how do we work to keep that family, especially mom and dad, keep that couple as healthy as possible so mom and dad have the resources, the energy, the insights, and the wisdom to carry on in the midst of a situation that's extremely exhausting and overwhelming. And we know pretty isolated, because what we've heard from our research and know from the people like yourself, the families tend to be very isolated. And they tend to, other people outside don't know what to do. I can remember growing up in a little town where my parents were the primary people who visited in funeral homes. They went to every funeral my mom sang in half of them. And they went to every funeral home for visitation, and they always visited the sick and so forth. I didn't like that as a kid because I didn't want to have to face unpleasant topics. Somebody would get cancer. Well, you don't know what to say to them. You just tend to avoid them. Well, you have a child with a chronic disability, that same kind of thing happens. We're going to try to break down those walls, provide the family with enough strength and wisdom, and build a community so we can help you stay as healthy as possible in your marriage, in your family. Because if you don't have health between you and your spouse, and maybe with your own extended family, what do you have left over to give your children? You may think, hey, I really want to do more for my child. You've got to be very, very careful to take care of yourself, learn yourself, continue to grow, and you and your spouse. By the way, one of the things I don't think we've mentioned so far, when we did our research with these families for about a year, one of the things that came out as very strongly was that almost every one of these families said, I must keep growing. I must continue to learn. I learn about myself, learn about my marriage, learn about the family system, learn how to help my child. And many of you have other children. It's not the only child you have. So you've got all these dynamics. It's like throwing a rock in a pond. And there's a circle that goes out from that rock. So the circle of the waves touches everybody in the family. And that's part of what Cindy and I want to talk about today. And then this is Cindy Weininger, who is a...
I'm a special needs mom, so I call myself the warrior mama. And our son is 3 years old with significant brain damage due to something in utero that we're not quite sure what it was. But I had worked with Gary for a number of years before Daniel came along. So that gives me a little bit of an ability to take some of these things and have had the opportunity to apply them over the last 3 years of Daniel's life. But I will say that this is probably one of my most passionate areas, because when Daniel was born, my brother-in-law, who's a pediatrician, said to me, he goes, the chances of your marriage making it through this are going to be so slim. He said, you need to either fight for your marriage and make a decision about that now, or know what the outcome is going to be. And so I know that there are so many marriages, and probably some of you in here, who the marriage has taken the toll in many ways. And so what Gary and I will talk about today isn't just that marriage, but it's significant relationships in your life too. So because I have found that the effect of our little special guy has such a ripple effect, and some of the tools that one in particular, triangling, that we'll talk about today, really has in many ways saved a lot of relationships in our life. And it's allowed me to give my husband a lot of grace in places where I thought I might otherwise kill him.
I think maybe the first time I heard the statistic of about 85% of the marriages where a special needs child comes along get a divorce may have been from you, from your brother-in-law.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you came back, he's from California, right?
Well,
this is the other one.
This is the other one, yeah.
And came back and had their baby and found out his, didn't know what the diagnosis was, but had a diagnosis. And they said, we want to be one of the 15% of the marriages that survive. And boy, that sounds so terribly high. I was a marriage and family therapist. I've never heard of any statistic that high. So that piqued my interest in working with Cindy and Jim after that. It does take work. This is not an easy road to hoe. And not only for you and your spouse, but in-laws and friends that you might have had in the past that fall away because they can't handle it anymore. They can't stand to face the pain of being with you, etc. So we want to try to help you, show you some of these things, especially on triangling today. We did adoption, but not, we did our research focused on intact families, middle class families, who could speak English and so forth, because we knew if you added something like a minority or extreme poverty or single parenting, it would skew the research. So it'd be great if we could do that kind of research on that special population and compare them. But we tried to have a controlled population of these 12 families. Otherwise, it would mess it up. We wouldn't know what was causing what. Does that make sense? Now, you can assume if you have extreme poverty or you have a divorce and other kinds of trauma in the family, it's going to add to the stress. It's not going to take anything away. And you can imagine, instant poverty for most of the people in America is single parenthood. That's a way that you want to be poor and your kids not have what they would have otherwise. So we know all that statistics already. Okay, so let's talk about this. Dorothy Faye, come up here, would you, and be with me. Now, Dorothy Faye is role-playing my wife. She is not my wife.
She's awfully cute, though, isn't she?
My wife is sitting right back there.
And she now, would not role play with him.
This is very funny, because Dorothy and I have worked together. She helped me write the book, Rational Christian Thinking. But she was role playing one time, oh gosh, this is 30 years ago, and she role played this woman whose husband was beating her, and she wept and cried, and people would come up and say, I'm so sorry to hear that Jerry's been beating you. She says, no, no, it's a role play. Oh, okay, yeah, we understand it.
10 years later, at a life seminar, someone from that conference came up to me who didn't hear the answer, what's the word, saying it, what, and said, how are things to be?
So let me be very clear. This is a role play. And we're not married, but we are very, very good friends, and like a brother and sister for many, many years. And this is one of the blessings of having a community. But I just want to show that. Let's just start, for example, that the first stage of marriage, we call it the honeymoon stage. You know, when you get married, you're so much in love, you just want to be together. It's that leave mother and father, cleave your spouse, and become one flesh. And that's one of those times when you first get married, it's kind of one flesh time. And you can't wait to be together. You spent a lot of time talking to each other before marriage, and then you get married. And that's a good thing. But the closeness, what I'm wanting to show you is that there's emotional and usually physical closeness at this stage in time. Now, other things can get involved in the middle of this marriage. But nothing gets involved in the middle of your marriage like a what? A kid. Roxanne. Roxanne is our daughter in the role play. She's not our daughter. And we're role playing as though she is a baby. Now, Roxanne, she has two children, and Dorothy has two children. Where do babies come in the family system?
They are right in the middle of everything.
Yeah, and I think, remember, for 9 months, for 9 months, you're right there. And for the year after that. So here's, you talk about bonding. You talk about bonding. From the
snap.
not too realistic, Roxanne. We don't want to change any diapers here. But this becomes, usually for a woman, really the biggest thing that's happened in their life. And all of a sudden, there's distance here. That's part of what I want to show you, that even when there's a pregnancy, there's distance. The couple is kind of split because this baby is in the middle. So this is one of the best ways I know to describe what happens to the whole family system. And sometimes even the mom, maybe her mother is, she's all of a sudden, she's reconciled with her mother who she wasn't talking to before. She couldn't wait to get out of that house. But she's pregnant, get a baby, and oh boy, I need a mother around now. And so all of a sudden, daddy is in a more distant role, emotional role, and we don't have all of that romantic interaction anymore, you know, where she's too busy, she's tired, I'm working. So do you see how the family system has changed? Very, very dramatically. And this is what we mean when we say every event that occurs in a family changes the configuration of the family, emotionally, maybe, and physically. And all of a sudden you got this kid that's hyper energetic maybe or whatever, and it changes things. So if that child is typical, healthy, exactly what you've been hoping for and praying for, it still changes the family system. Now if the child has severe illness of some kind, or just any illness, I used to hear my mom talk about colicky babies. Colicky babies. What's a colicky baby?
A miserable family.
A miserable family. That's right. They're sickly. They cough. They're trouble. They don't sleep. And when the conversation in a family after you have a new baby is, how's the baby? Oh, thank God she's sleeping through the night. Isn't it kind of what you hear? There's the smallest little things. Did she have a BM today? You talk about things you've never talked about in your life. BMs and sleeping through the nights and how's hot. No, that water's too hot or the milk is too, you know, your whole language changes. The family will never be the same. Now put on top of that, if this child is colicky or very ill and fragile and may even not make it. And you think of the anxiety, the stress, the worry, what happens, the guilt. We talked in our other workshop about guilt and shame and blame and anxiety, that if you start thinking, if Dorothy says, oh, I've really done something wrong to damage this child, it's my fault. That further keeps the family from coming together. And it's very rare that you have mom and dad as close before working with the child. It's rare. in our culture. Rarely does that happen. And that can be, that can still be healthy and functional, but if this works the other way, where there's a lot of conflict, and I'm feeling left out, I'm feeling pushed out, I'm feeling uncared for and unwanted, where the reason I married her was that she would spend time with me and listen to my crazy stories and jokes, and, oh, it's so wonderful, Gary, what you're saying. All of a sudden, she's not paying any attention to me. Right. Okay, you got the scenario? Does this make sense? Now, let's talk, if you want to add anything, I'm sure you've got plenty of ammunition.
Well, what I understood even more having Daniel, years of infertility for us, and then at 6 weeks finding out the severity of our situation and not thinking that he would even live for a year. So here I'm dealing with, you know, my hormones are insane. And I've always heard, you know, women play all these different roles of wife and mother and friend and daughter, but by far the most significant is mother. I mean, there's just such a an unconditional love attached to being mother. But then I think what I found is that with Daniel being special needs, it almost ramped that up to a different level because he was so helpless. And so that really put me in even more of a mother caretaker. I have to keep the child alive because every day was, you know, I wonder literally if he's going to make it through this day. And luckily, we had been tipped off to this by my brother-in-law and had gone to Gary, and Gary had started doing some research on it. And the advice that we got early on, which I know was, you know, special for us, and many people didn't get that advice, was the fact that Jim and I had to stay here. And it was hard because what Gary really said to us was, that means, Jim, that you're going to have to go to doctor's appointments. You're going to have to negotiate with your company some way or with your doctor some way that both of you go to doctor's appointments. Well, you know what? In our lifestyle, with Jim's career, with, you know, that was nearly impossible. I mean, it just, like, you've got to be kidding me that on top of all the caregiving and never getting to breathe really and in and out of the hospital, that now we both need to be at doctor's appointments. And that one thing began to be like a focus for us, a real goal for us. Because what we found was that if one of us went to the doctor's appointment, and not necessarily just the, you know, 6 month checkup kind of thing, but I'm talking the neurologist, the breathing specialist, the feeding team, all of that. If one of us went with Daniel without the other, then you're interpreting, and whoever heard the information is already the responsible party. It's like, you heard it, so you're the responsible one for that information. And by setting up just that one simple thing of being aware that if we didn't keep us together, us processing through all of that, then it was very quickly going to get separated. And there were times Jim couldn't go, and then I'd start trying to interpret what the doctor said, and we're very different people. I'm quick to open my mouth, I'm quick to make a decision, and Jim has to have time to process. So that one thing about doctor's appointments was huge. The second thing was that it was very hard for me to allow Jim to do things for Daniel. I mean, it was just, I wanted to be the one to do it. I didn't know if he'd live another day, and I didn't want to give him up. And so it was this incredible place of pushing Jim out. I mean, it wasn't really Daniel that pushed Jim out. I mean, if I were the mama, it was like, okay, you come on over here, and here, I'm going to be over here with my baby. Now, can you get me some food? Because I'm too busy over here. And it was so stinking easy to do that I had to keep catching myself, and it was out of complete and utter discipline, overriding of emotions and hormones and everything else that caused me to say, if I want a marriage at the end of this, then I have to put Jim. I mean, there were times my friends would laugh because I would call them from the car and they'd say, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm driving around the neighborhood because Jim thinks that I've gone to run errands, but I'm afraid to leave him there with him. And I mean, Jim's fabulous, but this was me. And so he's at home keeping Daniel alive. And I can't get more than a block away from my house, talk me down off the cliff.
Let me tell you one of the things that happened in this, and talking with Jim and Cindy about this. I said, here's one of the things you got to watch out for. I found in many, many marriages. So the wife is taking care of the baby and kind of pushes the man out, right? But then complains that he's not helping. So you have this, you're not doing enough, come and help, but she doesn't really want you to. So there's a double bind. And I wouldn't say most of us men are the most sensitive of figuring that out, period. And it's like, what the heck am I supposed to do? And some of the men who are very quiet and inward and introverted just go into the cave. And they kind of suck on their thumb, you know, or something. But the woman has to be very aware. And I remember talking to Cindy about this. Be careful. Because you may emotionally complain that he's not doing enough, but you really don't want him to because you're obsessed with taking care of Daniel. And I mm-hmm. think you saw that, didn't you?
Oh, it just was a given. You know, for me, it was just a given that I was, you know, the caregiver. I mean, Jim was going to have to wrestle him out of my hands. And it wasn't just Jim. I mean, for those who are doing this as a single parent, it is recognizing that allowing other people to come in and learn to care for the child or children is by far one of the hardest things you'll ever do. I mean, it's mind-boggling how hard it is for me to take, you know, we have friends, we've intentionally looked for people that would be willing to step in, and we're kind of their ministry. And so we, allowing other people to be a caregiver to Daniel and intentionally making that decision to train them and then leave him with them so that they bond and they're getting the joy of him in their life is the same kind of family system. I mean, we call it a family system, but it's a community system that we're talking about here of really being able to make that decision as a mom that other people get the privilege of loving Daniel. And so I have become in my head to get to a point of calling him our community child, because our community is different because people have gotten an opportunity to be his caregiver.
And let me say a word about this, knowing Cindy and Jim. Cindy is the poster child for the liberated woman, right?
I am. I'm pretty self-sufficient.
Pretty liberated. But when it came to this, she, quote, would slip back into, I am the mother, female, I must be the caregiver, which is kind of, nobody would go to a seminar and recommend that. But the heart is much stronger than any kind of philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so you may know all the right things, quote, in your head, but boy, that pull mm-hmm. of, I've got to mm-hmm. take care of my child and nobody else can do it. And he was fragile. He could die any time. So every day was a gift, but think of that. You're grieving every day the possibility of loss. Mm-hmm. So the emotions are incredibly right. intense.
Well, and it also leads you down that path of the acknowledgement that you're both grieving, and yet darned if you're not grieving in the same stage at the same time the other person is. You know, so that part, I mean, on Jim's...
Now say that again.
Yeah. There's stages of grief, you know. So I can be in a stage where I'm in total denial. Like, I'll get into my head, oh, we're going to have Daniel when he's 20. Well, you know, probably not, if we're real. But Jim can be over in the stage of true, like, sadness at that moment. So he's sad that we're not going to have Daniel, you know. And so I am royally, you know what, at him about the fact that he's over being, you know, Eeyore, that Daniel's not going to live, and the stage of denial that I am of grief that he's going to live. And so all of a sudden, not only do you have just the caregiving, but you've got the emotional space between the two of you that has to be navigated through. And I think that's true with everybody. I mean, there are days that a family member will call and say, aren't you glad that, you know, that he's still with you? And you're like, shut the heck up. He's going to be with me. Whereas another day, I need to say that. You know, and so this family system thing of really centering back on those people that are in our lives that have chosen to be part of our community, especially, I mean, we're using the example of husband-wife, but... You know, this is about each of you as an individual and looking at this, you know, how it plays out. I mean, my best friend can call up on a day that she's grieving And she's in the place of, oh, your life is a mess, and what are you going to do when Daniel's gone? And you know what? There's a part of me that wants to say to her, call another friend. Don't call me to process your grief. I'm the one it's happening to here. But in my head, it's that recognition of who do I want to be like this with? Who do I want to walk through this with? And I need to choose a number of people in our community along with Jim, and I need to walk through their grief with them and allow them that space the same way that I need to allow it in mine. And that is a hard place to get to, depending on where you are in that process.
And when Cindy had that insight and shared it with me, it's the first time I've ever thought about that. That everybody in your family and the other children, I don't want to forget the siblings, your kids, your own siblings, your parents, and so forth, are all going through this stuff at different stages, different speed. So not understanding that can really add enormously to your stress. Yeah.
Not all of our children are medically fragile with that diagnosis, but different types of disabilities. But there's a grief, I think, that will always be with me, and it's grieving the typical child that my son might have been. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lifespan grief, I think. I don't think I'll ever shed it. And so I think recognizing also that my wife and my daughter, typical daughter, probably share that as well and probably are in different phases at different times throughout the entire process.
The first child born in my family died at 3 days. My dad never got over his grief. And that often occurs. And I think having grace for yourself, mercy for yourself and your spouse and the people around you saying, well, this is not only okay, but it's normal, natural, it's going to happen. So how do you give grace to yourself and the rest of your family rather than getting, you know, when you're frustrated or angry or grieving and sad, and I'm at a different place than my wife, and we may want to fight a little bit rather than saying, it's okay, it's normal and natural. If she's at the place where she's kind of in denial and I'm Eeyore, you know, really glum and sad, to recognize that. Otherwise, we're always blaming the spouse or the other children. And I'm thinking here, see that Chuck, come up here, would you be a role play? Let's say Chuck is an older child and that's a sibling. And he's been used to being real close to mom, right? And all of a sudden this special needs kid comes in here and what happens? So do you see why the siblings are affected too, and they have all kinds of emotions. And we have to be very, very careful that we don't give all of our time and energy to the special needs child and not give any energy anymore to the quote, typical child.
Well, and this affected us because Jim and I admit that I do trend towards a little self-sufficiency in a neurotic way. And so we had a lot of friends that were used to us having extra space. You know, if they were hurting or if something was going on or they needed help, well, we were the dual income, no kids, love to help couple.
The 911 couple.
We were. I mean, and that was fine with us. You know, we love helping. And all of a sudden, what happened with us is, you know, Chuck isn't a sibling in our household. Chuck is a lot of these friends that are used to us being the giving family. And we didn't have anything. In fact, we, you know, really yanked his chain because we needed some help. And we were shocked in the system of things how some people just completely disappeared out of our lives. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of like, where did they go? But it was helpful for us to realize that there were some people in the system that could deal with the grief of our situation and the chaos. I mean, it's chaotic. You know, no matter what level of special needs your children are, it's a whole different universe. And there were some that we had to give the grace to walk away from our lives.
Right. Because they had seen, you know, you might be seeing Cindy, let's say Chuck, in this case, saw Cindy and Jim. They're my big brother and sister. I can always depend on them. They're the strong ones. They're the wise ones. And that's great. And all of a sudden, they don't have any of that, and they can't change. They can't handle that change. They can only relate to you as the strong, wise, always available person. And then you're hurt or they're rejecting you. Well, this stuff really happens. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wondered if you could speak a little about
how do you respond to people who can't handle it, that they, in our first session, Cindy did a whole thing on how do you deal with people who do stupid things, and the world seems to be full of them. And how do you deal with that? We'll get that video out before long. But how do you deal with it? And especially parents or grandparents we know who maybe they're feeling overwhelmed. I can't believe this is my DNA that's caused this or something. You know, there's all kinds of irrational stuff. And they withdraw. Is that the question? How do you deal with it?
Yeah. How do you, when you've got people that are in kind of the inner circle that want to dump on you their grief, what do you do in that case? That, okay, a couple of ideas for you, because I'm in this with y'all. I'm still figuring out every day. Somebody asked me the topic of this class a little while ago, and I was like, I don't know. I'm just going. So,
see what we can learn together.
I know. I'm in it with y'all. Number one, and this is, I'm giving you a real answer based on me, not the expert, okay? I literally, and this is going to sound so ridiculously harsh, I draw something that looks like a target every year, and I put it, I do it by time, like who would I call back within, you know, an hour, and who am I going to call back within a day, and who's in the 24-hour window, and who's in the 48, and then who the heck is in the all other. And I was surprised how many people went from my two-hour window out to my 24-hour window of time, so that I had a mental boundary of who do I trust to get to me when I may not be ready for them to get to me. So that was, one wasn't even preparing how to have that conversation with them. It was preparing how not to have that conversation with them. So that, and my best friend laughs because she'll call every year and she'll go, hey, I'm feeling like I'm out in the 36-hour plus window with you. And I'm like, you are so perceptive on that one, aren't you? I mean, we've been friends for almost 30 years, you know. But, and I'll say to her, you know, Kath, where you are right now, this is all I got for you. And so, secondly, is I've said to people on a regular basis, I really want to be here for you, and I know you're grieving. Can we kind of identify one other person in your life that might be able to listen to you in this? Because there are just times that your grief is overwhelming to me. I have just had to get to a place where I change the subject. I go, it is hard. And I, you know what, Daniel's screaming and I have to go. Or, you know what, it is hard, but really, once you change poopy diapers of this child versus another child, it's all the same, isn't it? Or, I mean, just, and I'll plan those. I mean, I'll plan that neutralizing, paradoxing answer just to, you know, I talked in the last thing about stop, drop, and roll. I stop the conversation. I drop underneath what she's trying to do with me at that moment, and I just roll on to something else. And after a while, you know, she's, I'm not the dumping ground anymore. I hope that helps. I mean, you know, okay.
I think for one piece of counsel for you all and parents, you have a child like this and you're getting unsolicited advice or dumping. When I was teaching, I was on staff at College Hill Press, and we were teaching a lot of people about listening and so forth. One of the things that we did that people would call and want to dump, and you said, I have to give you my boundary. I have 5 minutes or 2 minutes, or I don't have any time right now. And why don't you call somebody else that's a listener? So you have to be very clear and very assertive. What your limits are that doesn't suck you dry. When we talk about vampires, you know, there are some people in your life who are just suck you dry. And you have to set some boundaries without being mean. What she's saying, stop, drop, and roll. So you stop the thing, you drop down under it, you roll out of it. And so kind of think of it that way.
All right, and can we do triangles? Because I want to make sure we get this in. Can I use you guys? Gary and I are going to. Okay, so follow along with me. It took me forever to get this, so if you don't get it, it's just because I'm terrible at teaching, and I learned it straight from Gary, so you know where to go. In a situation, all right, we're going to call her the persecutor. She looks awfully too sweet to be the persecutor, but we're going to call her the bad guy, okay? And with a persecutor, they're the ones that's just doing something. And let's say that she is, we'll just call her in your family system your sister, Okay? So your sister keeps calling and saying, you know, well, you need to do this, or you need to do that, or you need to do the other. And if you'd only do this, and you shouldn't have adopted, and you shouldn't have blah, 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 blah. Okay? And after a while, this person, this is you. You're the receiving end. You try to change it. You try to fix the system. You try to do all this stuff. And after a while, you feel like you're the victim. Like, stop it. Are you kidding me? Can we move on from this? You're not hearing any boundary I set. You're not doing anything. So the victim runs out. We're going to put you right in the front in the middle. The victim runs out and tries to find somebody that will rescue the situation, somebody that I can talk to, complain about my sister, you know, like somebody save me, all right? And this person, all of a sudden, and y'all have seen this before with A talks to B, B goes to C. What I never realized until I worked with Gary is that after a while, this person here who's the victim is so done with that person over here, they start getting frustrated with this person that they're not fixing it.
All right? Persecutor, Dorothy's persecutor, victim, rescuer, okay? Now the victim gets upset and says, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. This is the person here that's trying to rescue, and so she gets upset with the rescuer. If the persecutor, which could be a complainer, griper, advice giver, you know, you should be, if you just prayed more, if you just believed more, if you just had more faith, your baby would be okay. You know, that kind of, that's really what we mean by somebody that's kind of saying these things and it's wearing you down. So then she goes to Chuck, who tells him, and he tries to get in the middle and straighten her out. So he's running back and forth between. Then if a persecutor persecutes the victim and a rescuer tries to rescue, often the victim accuses the rescuer of being the persecutor, and it reverses roles. So if you are in the habit of trying to rescue somebody over and over and over, and it could be your disabled child, to rescue your disabled child from your spouse or an in-law or something, you be very, very careful that you don't end up being perceived as a persecutor, because the roles will change. This is the triangle. It's called the rescue triangle.
All right, let me give y'all an outside example of this that has nothing to do with special needs. Gary taught me this one back when Hurricane Katrina hit. Okay, so Hurricane Katrina comes through, and it is the bad guy. All right, it's the persecutor. The people of New Orleans are the victim. They're hurting. They're in total and complete pain over what's happening. But they can't fix Mother Nature. They can't go back over here and stop Mother Nature from coming through and happening. So what they do is they look around and try to find a rescuer. And the rescuer is the government. All right?
You can take care of the Mother Nature, right?
And they look to the government and say, fix it, fix it, fix it, fix it. And the government's like, we're trying. And granted, I'm not arguing that there weren't some major screw-ups there. But, you know, bottom line is, all this attention ended up getting put on something that really wasn't the issue. The issue was over here. Now, I told y'all going into this, it's not the easiest concept to get, but it is one of the most significant, important concepts ever in this process of family systems. Because what happened over and over for us, and it still happens to this day, is something will go wrong with the chaos of our situation. And I'm overwhelmed by it. And then I'm over mad at Jim about something because I want this fixed and I can't. I'm helpless. And I've transferred all this energy over to my husband that he was just, you know, the government. Unable to fix Mother Nature. Mm-hmm.
My daughter is 20, and I'm the rescuer,
yeah.
And she's the victim, yeah. And the world is over there as the persecutor.
Yeah.
So she's dumping mighty on me. Of course, she's 20. She's you know going to be doing that anyway.
Sure.
But that is very, very hard for our whole family to deal with. that, you know, the more you try to help her and the more that you're in there rescuing her, I understand that it's safe for her to dump on me.
Right.
And I take that, but I'm not really happy with that role, and I'm not sure that that's a healthy role for her. So I'm trying to figure out how to work out of that.
Right. It's like all of us who've tried to rescue poor people. We're not going to ever have any more poor people in the world. How's that working for us? And you get blamed then because you're not doing enough. So this is a very, very good point that if we also call it codependent or, you know, all those terms that we have, overfunctioners, that if you try too much. Now, here's one. I'll give you an example I heard within the last couple of years. A couple had, Dorothy and I had two children, okay? And this child's a special needs child. And the other child, for Christmas. And the father says, you know what? I want to get the kids a Wii, you know, the Wii game, so we can play Wii. And especially Chuck, he's getting to the age where he really likes that kind of thing, and I could play golf with him, and they do all those games. You know what the Wii is, don't you? Now, and so mom turns around and says, no, because I must protect my daughter. She can't play Wii. Overprotection, trying to protect her. Now, how does that the child, the other child, quote, feel? Going to blame her for being the persecutor. And that is a small example of how sometimes we try to overprotect, because by overprotecting this child, it's not going to change her disability at all. It isn't going to change anything. It just keeps the family dynamics dysfunctional. Rather than saying, maybe that's a stage of grief, you know, kind of, if I don't get the other kids, Wii or the other child, then it'll be better for this child. It's not going to change this child's situation a lick. But so you have to be very, very careful not to kind of over-function or over-perform, over-rescue anyone in the family. Just speaking that directly. Because once you start doing that, then sometimes you'll find yourself in a fight. You know, so then the child may come home getting into a fight with his mom. Or he's not doing well at school. He was doing really well in school, let's say. But all of a sudden he comes home, he's not doing well, and his mother says, you know, and so they're fighting. And then she says, well, what's wrong with this kid? He's always been studying well. Well, it may be sub rosa. It may be coming out of something that happened here, not the direct. It isn't because he can't do good grades. Probably family dynamics happening. And she would never think that it was because she was rescuing her daughter, quote unquote, because this is a very, as Christians, we should be serving, right? We've got to be taking care of these people. But quite often, the people who do the most rescuing then from the public and other people, they get attacked. Right? You had that experience? So you have to be really kind of careful about that and understand where it's coming from. That's the rescue triangle. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to abstract the model a little bit. What if the persecutor is the disability, the victim is the child, and so then the rescuer becomes the parent by proxy.
Right.
And then, so then that could create conflict between the parent and the child. Would it be useful to try to disperse the rescuing among other parties, and so that it isn't always the same rescuer?
Rescuing, in our terminology, is doing more than you need to do. Let me give you quick rules. It's my Humpty Dumpty book out there in the bookstore. The golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The lead rule, do unto others what they ought to be doing for themselves. The stone rule, try to do for others what only God can do. And a lot of times the parents or anybody else got a sick child, they're, in this case, it may be that you are doing for your daughter what she really could do for herself. That would be the lead rule. Or the stone rule. What I find in a lot of families with chronic disability, they're wanting so bad to heal their kid, they'll do anything. They'll spend zillions of dollars. You know, they've got to find this magical cure. That's magical Christian thinking. So a lot of times you need help saying, oh, you're trying to do something. You're trying to interfere with this disease or the diagnosis, whatever it is, of the child, and you're getting right in the middle of that rather than backing up. Of course, do what you can do. But when you see people get obsessed with this disease, it's probably coming out of something other than rational thought. Does that make sense to you?
I guess as a parent, it's hard to draw that line. So what's excessive?
Yeah, his comment back is, as a parent, it's hard to draw that line and what's excessive. And right. I think what we have found, you know, we're in the one child situation, but what we have found with nieces and nephews that were very close to us and then felt displaced in the whole thing is that we had to come back around to figuring out not only the dynamic of the whole family, but the relationship with each person. And asking, you know, what is my relationship with this individual child in our family? And then what is their relationship with Daniel, the disabled child, and separate those things out. And that's, I get that it's very hard to do, but once we got conversations going about what are your expectations, what do you want, it was amazing how honest that the other kids in our life got with us.
And I think, too, you're absolutely right. It has to do with our kids and any need they have. But when you're so obsessed with the outcome rather than the relationship, as though you can change the outcome. Just to be another quick example that's not related to disability, I do a lot of coaching for pastors, Christian leaders. They become obsessed about church growth. Well, you can't make the church grow. If you get obsessed about how much money people give or how big the church gets, see, you're looking at this goal over here. You have no effect on it. So you're trying to, quote, rescue people that are not wanting to be rescued or can't be rescued. Now, if you know what you can do that's helpful, or preach well or pastor well, and then that's what you can set your goal on, treat your child or treat that situation as best you can. But if you're obsessed, I think you're really in denial. That's in the denial stage of grief. Yeah.
I appreciate the insight. There's a lot of good view here on the dynamics and recognizing the dynamics when they're occurring. And a lot of the times it's being able to spot them and recognize that that's what's happening. Yeah. When our daughter was born, she has Down syndrome and autism, and which was a little bit of a surprise to us. We didn't know it was coming. And our pastor at the time, I'll never forget, she was only a few days old, and his wisdom to us was, learn how to accept people's awkward way of trying to love you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've seen through the years is that a lot of times the persecutor or the person who's giving us all this advice, they're doing it because they love us.
Yes.
And they're trying to reach out and help. Right. In a way, and they don't know, they haven't been trained, they're not familiar with it. So they're reaching out the best way they think can help us.
Yep.
And so our ability to spot that often gave us the spiritual basis to recognize what they were trying to do and not interpret it as persecuting us or giving us too much advice, but they were simply trying to love us through the process.
Yeah, people want to help. And that's why they're doing it. They may be a little bit clumsy with it, that's for sure. And I think, you know the Serenity Prayer? All of you know the Serenity Prayer? It probably would have been a good idea to put that in the notes. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. So I think, you know, and being a counselor or a pastor, 90% of the time people are obsessed with things they can't change and can't accept it. You know, and the wisdom to know the difference. So it's not easy, or we wouldn't have to have these classes and stuff. But it is something, we're trying to show you how the dynamics, and you can sort of observe the patterns in your family. And if you're constantly getting upset with another member of your family or your spouse because they're at a different stage, or you don't think they're doing enough, or you're doing too much, you say, whoa, wait a minute, the patterns are not, this is not working. If it's not working, stop it. If it is working, do more of it. and it's fairly simple. And so if you're in a pattern with your spouse where you're chronically upset with them, they're not doing the right thing and all. You're not on the same page, you know. This is the most important relationship, the spouse, not you and your kid. Because no matter what you do with your child, if you and your spouse are not living in harmony, the child is going to pick it up. It's not going to be functional for them. Okay?
All right, and can I know we're short on time. I'm going to let you guys sit down.
Thank you, guys.
Because one thing that I want to say on that, and then we'll be here and can answer a few questions. The biggest thing about this triangling is just to get the concept today. Because what I find is that the only way to really manage things from around triangles is to anticipate them. Because these don't show up. You're not going to be, you know, in a phone conversation all of a sudden go, okay, I'm in a triangle and I'm rescuing. Mm-hmm. All right. It's to actually take a few minutes sometime in the course of your week to take a step back from the places that are irritants in your life and look for the triangle. Look for what are the predictive patterns that are going on and then figure out, you know, so how do we get out of the triangle? We neutralize it and we don't play the game in the triangle. Yeah. And so it's the being able to recognize it well in advance and plan out a little bit of a response. You know, and a response might be just as simple as saying, you know, thanks for that advice, but could we maybe in the future have an agreement that unless I'm asking, listening would be really helpful. And I love you. And just plan ahead of time for, I call it my media management. You know, and they're going to do it again. It's the whirlwind of dysfunction, and people want you in it. They want to suck you into the way they want to handle your grief. And the minute you stop, they're going to kind of hit you, but they're going to come back around and hit you harder. And so getting one sentence with folks of just saying, you know, and I will say it over and over again. I'll say, I know that this is a really hard thing on you, and it's hard on us, but right now I don't have the energy to talk about it. And the phone call will ring. It's amazing. 20 minutes later, I know. But you know what? I've kind of already said, I know this is hard on you. It's hard on us too. And right now, I don't want to talk about it. And then sometimes the phone call doesn't come for another 2 weeks.
Thank you. We remind you, we have the final session. And afterwards, we're going to have the prayer team available for any of you want prayer after hearing this. You've got false guilt or shame or blame or straighten out. Wally and his team will be up front down here at the end. Thank you so much. Lord bless you. We look forward to seeing you again.